This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
In the past for these sessions, I have typically gone through the classic koan collections or the Shobo Genzo to find a passage to comment on. But today I thought I would instead talk about the koan that most of you are actually working on, which is Why Am I Not There Yet? With its corollaries of what should I be doing differently, what am I doing wrong? The key words there, of course, I'm not there yet, and doing, what should I be doing? And there's a way in which we've heard over and over again that nirvana is already here, and zazen is not a technique. And yet, there's something very ingrained in us that causes us to experience a sense of a gap or a lack and inspires us to feel like we need to be doing something, and that practice is synonymous with that effort. When we went around in the outside Kinhin this morning, you may have noticed we passed a big iron gate, and there was a sign on it that said, "This gate is unlocked." Just like Mumon said, right? Gateless gate. Of course, we just walked right past it. Nobody went through. An interesting perspective on our whole frame of reference is one that I've just come across studying something about Pure Land Buddhism. Not something we usually give much attention to in the Zen school. Imagining that Pure Land is practically a simple kind of folk religion in which practitioners recite the name of Amida Buddha, Namo Amida Butsu, in the hope of being reborn in the Pure Land. And no doubt it does have that simple faith-based function for a lot of practitioners over the years. But I've been reading about one of its principal founders, Shinran, and his approach and philosophy was actually quite different and quite sophisticated. He was a near contemporary of Dogen. Dogen, you'll recall, born in 1200, died in 1253. Shinran, born earlier, 1173, I believe, but lived longer to 1263. So he had a long life compared to Dogen, who died relatively young, but they overlapped in that 13th century. And they're very interesting ways in which they were similar, and that they both were reacting to this kind of means to an end conception of meditation. For Dogen, as you know, he talks about the identity of practice and realization, the identity of zazen and realization, that zazen is not a means to become enlightened. It's an expression of our Buddha nature, of our enlightenment. That we enact who and what we are through zazen. We don't become something different. And Shinran felt that also the recitation of the name of Amida Buddha was not a means to an end. He said that it's true that it's used in two ways. There's a provisional way, but also a true way. And the provisional way is sort of the common notion that it's a means to an end, to be reborn, to make something happen. But that the true way of reciting the name of Amida Buddha, who's, I gather, one of the kind of mythical Buddhas of the past who was reincarnated as Shakyamuni, calling on the name of this Buddha enacts a renunciation of all self-power in favor of other power, of total reliance on Amida Buddha, who has vowed to, as a bodhisattva, not enter nirvana until all beings are enlightened. And so in calling upon his name, we trust that his vow has actually been fulfilled already. Not something that he's going to do for us in the future, but that this ancient Buddha, in fact, fulfilled his vow to save all beings. What struck me most about this, though, was the very kind of practical way in which he talks about the practice of this, which is a practice of, first of all, kind of rigorous psychological honesty. That acknowledges that everything we do in our practice is shot through and through with gaining ideas and ego and desire and attachment, that it's impossible to approach any kind of religious practice without our longings, our attachments contaminating what we call aspiration. It was very, seemed very familiar to me and very much in line with what I've written about as a secret practice. And Shinran says this is absolutely inevitable and unavoidable. As long as you're a human being, as long as you think conceptually, as long as you suffer, you're going to be wrapped up in these kinds of gaining ideas. He says, I myself am absolutely floundering in an ocean of desire and attachment. Right? The recognition of this for him means I absolutely cannot count on somebody as screwed up as me as figuring out how to get enlightened, right? It's not going to happen if it's going to be up to me. I'm a mess, right? There's no way I am going to pull myself up by my bootstraps and eliminate all this desire and attachment. All I can do is completely acknowledge my helplessness. And in doing that, in that moment of total surrender to my situation, when I call upon Amida Buddha, I realize that his vow is fulfilled. There's nothing I need to do. There's nothing I can do right or wrong. It's already all accomplished, right? There's this kind of complete letting go. And in that moment, there's a genuine release of some kind. Now that kind of practice, called other directed practice, is typically contrasted with what that old man recommended, you know, what the Zen model of Bodhidharma, who's a very unusual figure. He's the first Zen patriarch who brings, an Indian who brings Zen to China. And he also embodies, in the stories we hear about him, deep images of surrender. The first story we hear about him of having an audience with the Chinese emperor, who asks him, "Who are you?" And he says, "I don't know." He goes and sits in a cave for 9 years, doing nothing at all. Not proselytizing, not teaching, not preaching, renouncing any seeming active work to spread the Dharma. He just sits there, does nothing. A disciple finally comes, who he rejects, and the disciple goes to the extent of cutting off his arm to prove his determination. At one level, cutting off your arm is a complete abdication of agency. Right? Symbolically, you cut off an arm, then you can't do anything with it. Combine that with his sense of, "I don't know," and cutting off an arm, you have these two powerful pictures of no agency, of complete surrender. And yet, paradoxically, what comes down to us is a picture of Bodhidharma of absolute, fierce, unyielding determination and ascetic practice. And, you know, the Zen model of this would be something like, yes, we believe in surrender, but we know you're not going to surrender without a fight. And so that there's an image of a kind of almost militaristic conquering or killing of the ego as the nature of this practice. And we create in traditional Zen an almost military barracks kind of lifestyle of sleeplessness, physical endurance, enduring great physical pain, building up great toughness, right? All of this sort of in the service of absolutely driving the ego to a breaking point, and then it will surrender. Right? Shinran aims at a similar surrender, but through a completely different path of acknowledgement rather than of a battle. Right? The acknowledgement of vulnerability, of being stuck in attachment and having to let go and rely on something else. Now, the way I think this applies to us here is when we surrender, or be asked to surrender in a sesshin, it's not as if we're calling on Buddha in some other realm to save us. What we're asked to do is simply surrender to the sesshin itself, to give ourselves over to it, to let sesshin carry our life completely for these few days. And if we follow Shinran's model, we would observe how completely unwilling we are to do that. See, he contrasts other-directed with self-directed. And we would have to acknowledge how much we really want to hold on to our own ideas of control and liking and disliking in the middle of sesshin. And we can do that in a lot of small or big ways. Almost everybody finds some little aspect of the routine or the rules that they decide don't apply to them. Right? They're not important, they don't fit me, or I'm just not going to do it. I don't want it. Sometimes that means, you know, arriving with a suitcase full of the food that they have to have because I don't like what they're going to serve, or I have to have a snack at night, or I've got low blood sugar, I've got something, I have to be able to have my, you know, protein bar or my chocolate bar. Everybody, you know, there's always somebody who's smuggling something in, right? And they're the people who've got to make sure they've got their phones or their tablets, and that there's always got to be some little check-in or extra stimulus, because it's going to get boring, you know, and I have to be able to stay in touch. Or I have to be able to talk and be witty and clever and, you know, find little ways to get around rules of silence. Right? In a way, none of these things in themselves are any big deal. And I'm not at all interested in playing bad cop, you know, catching people at things. The point is that kind of awareness of one's own attempt to hold on to control and hold on to likes and dislikes. Just the sense that even in the midst of sesshin, there's this strong impulse to, I want to have it my way, just a little bit. You know, in the old days we used to just think about fidgeting and moving as the most basic manifestation of that. I just don't want to have a painful experience. I'm going to change it. I'm going to fix it. Right? I can't let myself go into having that physical sensation. It scares me too much. Or sleeplessness might be that way. See, and at the same time, to the same time we're tweaking all the little rules to our advantage, we're in the midst of judging ourselves about not being the real thing and not having the experience we want to have, or not practiced all these years and I'm still not X, whatever you think you're supposed to be, right? After this, right? And everybody still gets caught up in that feeling that somehow my mind is wandering more than anybody else's, right? Or my knees hurt more than anybody else's, or I'm so filled with distraction and preoccupation with, you know, the other people and what they're doing. It doesn't feel the way real Zen is supposed to feel. See, we carry around some version of this scowling old man who tells us we're not doing it right. And we convince ourselves that somehow constant criticism is going to prod us into doing better. Yet it just reinforces a sense that there's something wrong with me, or there's something wrong with this group or this teacher or this practice, because it's obviously not working, right? What's interesting, though, about old Bodhidharma is that he's depicted in these scrolls, and, you know, he's one of the most commonly painted figures in these old Japanese scrolls. And he always has two kinds of aspects to him. One, he's inevitably scowling or frowning, very fierce. And at the same time, there's always something a little cartoonish or ridiculous about him. See, they're always done comically. They're always done in a way that pokes fun at his severity. Because something tells us that that is the way to get out from under this Zen superego of ours. It's not by one day finally being perfectly meticulous or being, you know, tougher or more driven or sitting longer hours than anybody else. Although, you know, God knows I've been in groups where people try it for a considerable length of time. No, there's a way in which, in the end, the way you escape that superego is to laugh at it. Right? That's one version of sort of seeing it as empty. Right? That it's, what did I think I was doing? What did I think this was all for? Right? What did I think was wrong? It's silly. Just with memory of an old cartoon like Bodhidharma. This one is a little newer, but it also depicts an old monk sitting in the mouth of a cave way the hell out in the middle of the Himalayan mountains someplace. You see out there, there's nothing. You know, he's just this guy in the cave. But he's got a young disciple with him, sitting next to him. And the young disciple is looking at the old monk in a very, very upset way. And the old monk is saying to him, What do you mean, what's next? This is it.